Valentine's Day is almost here, and so the Book Review has its first love story issue to celebrate. First up, what has Daniel Jones learned from editing the Modern Love column for 10 years? Jones, whose new book, Love Illuminated, is reviewed in this week's issue, will be here to reveal all.
People are really falling very easily into deep, deep emotional relationships with people online. Part of how they fall into them so quickly is because they think there's no possibility, so you're not really inhibited.
And what can literature teach you about love? Parul Sehgal, a staff editor at the Book Review, will talk about this week's roundup, in which celebrated authors from Hilary Mantel to Chris Ware share their thoughts.
You know, reading novels makes us more empathetic, it makes us more compassionate, it can make us smarter. So we thought, you know, well, what do love stories teach us? Do we love any better?
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Daniel Jones joins us now. He is the author of Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers. Hi, Dan.
Hi, happy to be here.
So you are also, and not unrelated to this book, the editor of the New York Times column Modern Love, which appears every Sunday in the Sunday Style section and known to many. Is this book kind of a culmination of your 10 years editing that column?
Yeah, this book started 2 years ago. You know, when you have a job that's deadline-driven and submissions pouring in over the transom all the time, you're doing your work, but it's hard to sort of pull your head up and get a perspective of what's happening and what the trends are and how all these, you know, stories are teaching people about how love has changed and mm-hmm. how it's the same and all of that. So this book was really a project of figuring out what I know and what I've learned.
In the 10 years that you spent on
exactly.
this column. Okay, let's go inside baseball for a moment, because Modern Love is one of those columns that I think is so beloved by readers, not just for the content, but also its very openness, because it's not just professional writers who submit pieces to this, but it's really opened to anyone who wants to write about this great big topic of love. How many submissions do you get?
I got about 100 a week. So rounds out at 5,200 a year. So the chances of getting published are 1 in 100. It's true that I pay very little attention to the cover letter and where the person is coming from. I don't have time for that almost.
Yes.
I really just want to dive straight into the story and see if it captures me. And some of my proudest essays in the column are just from people who they'd really never written an essay before.
Right.
They'd never told their story before, but it was such a good story and so important to them, and that came through. And often those are the kinds of essays that have the biggest impact with readers, too, who want that kind of voice. They almost prefer that kind of voice and get a little tired of a byline that says they have a novel coming out.
Right, sort of right. Rather than us boring professional. No, I mean, I think that it's that kind of rawness that comes from more amateur, quote-unquote amateur writers out there.
And often published writers have told their story.
Yes.
You know, they've mined that maybe for a couple of decades already. And for a lot of other people, this is it. This is their voice coming out for the first time.
And it's also, it's not just your book that's come out of this column, but it's also become quite the launch pad for a number of books over the years that began as a modern love essay.
Yeah, there have been 38 book deals just that I know of.
Are you getting a little cut of these proceeds, Dan?
I get zero cut. Sometimes I get acknowledgments and appreciate it, but I've made friends with a lot of these people too. At one point I figured out doing the math that was one in 12 or 1 in 13 essays published led to a book deal, which I just thought was kind of astounding ratio.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard on the part of writers say, you know, oh, I want to get this in Modern Love, and then I'm going to, you know, take it to the
yeah.
book market. And so here is your chance with this book. One other procedural question. I'm just curious, even though you get 100 of these submissions a week, do you find yourself thinking, you know, why don't we have a story about X, or how come nobody has done Y, and soliciting writers to write about topics that you feel like are undercovered in the column?
Yeah, I don't solicit anybody. That has changed over the years, because in the early years of the column, it was sort of the great wide open, and I had all these topics that I wanted to cover. And sometimes I would contact writers about them and say, do you have anything? Are you writing on this topic? After 4 or 5 years, 6, 7 years, I felt like we'd covered about every nook and cranny
right.
of human love and sexuality. And there was sort of a freedom in that. And now I feel like I can just take essays that move me and that I think will move others, or that are, show something that I hadn't even thought of before. If you have 500 essays about love and relationships that have been published, you've covered a lot of ground at that
right.
point.
The column's kind of like a modern iteration of an Ann Landers, in that you can kind of get a sense of the pulse of American relationships and what the concerns are. What's the topic that you get the most submissions on?
A lot about using technology in various ways to connect. That's increasingly becoming a topic that people are writing about.
And you have
exploring.
A chapter in your book about this.
Yeah, there's a chapter that I call Connection, which you think of as being, emotional connection. But people are really falling very easily into deep, deep emotional relationships with people online. Part of how they fall into them so quickly is because they think there's no possibility. So you're not really inhibited.
If
you're meeting someone online, you start to
not that
feel
much at
close
stake.
And you feel like there's this bond, and this emotional connection races way out ahead of any sort of physical connection. And yeah, they fall pretty deep, and then it can be crushed pretty hard if they end up doing
10 years ago, was that the most popular topic, or is that really increased over that decade?
That's definitely increased over time. I don't think the technology was at a point where people were having those kinds of relationships so regularly, and now it's really happening.
Do you feel like over a period of time, writers might say, okay, he's done Infidelity, he's done May December, he's done this, but he hasn't done, Falling in Love with a Cantaloupe, or, do you feel like you get these kind of out there submissions?
I completely do. I get very out there submissions sometimes. Our rule is it has to be about people. Mm-hmm. It can't be Love of Paris, which I've gotten. It can't be Love of Jane Austen, which I've gotten.
Comforting in its way to the book reading audience here.
Yes.
Was there any submission that you got that you just, were there ones that you knew were risky, were on the fence about publishing and did and were happy that you did so?
Yeah, there have been several that I've been worried about, because when you put these essays out there, when I first had the job, I was pretty naive about it. You learn sort of what people can get their heads around and what readers are comfortable with and what ways you can make them uncomfortable that are good. Or can lead to good things. But there was a piece, one piece that got a big reaction, was about a woman who was dating a man who'd been kicked out of Harvard for date rape. She was lamenting how that had made him so gun-shy in their sex life that it pretty much ended their relationship. And that really landed like an exploding bomb among the readership, with a lot of people appreciating it, a lot of people shocked about it,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people going back and revisiting this case.
Right.
And then saying, how dare you reopen this in a way? But again, it was her perspective. It was her experience with this man, and it was a valid experience that was incredibly interesting to see how does that impact a future relationship.
Which essays have provoked the most response from readers?
Well, the most by far was an essay from 2006, I believe, called What Shamu Taught Me About a Happy Marriage, which I think stayed at the top of the Times most emailed list for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And at the time, it was the most emailed ever in the New York Times online history. I'm not sure if that's still the case. It just hit every button. It was how you can change or work to change your spouse's behavior,
mm-hmm.
In ways that you've been trying to. It was funny. It dealt with, it was written by a woman named Amy Sutherland, who had been to an exotic animal training academy.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a place like SeaWorld, where they train these animals to do things. And she tried those same techniques on her husband and found them remarkably effective.
In the book, you also write a lot about your own marriage with Kathy Hanauer, also a writer, a novelist, and an essayist and editor in her own right. The two of you edited kind of companion volumes a while back. She, of course, did The Bitch in the House, and then you retaliated with The Bastard on the Couch. How is this experience different from working on that book?
You know, those books led to the Modern Love column. The two books together had gotten the attention of Trip Gabriel, who was then the style editor, and he wanted to run that kind of material and styles and hired us to do it as a couple.
Bring that bitch and bastard to the Times.
I know. You know, those books were really figuring out what the zeitgeist was in terms of midlife marriage and what mostly professional women were struggling with in their marriages and how men were reacting to that. This book, for me, is really an exploration of really more of a kind of timeless love. It does have aspects of contemporary relationships in it and technology, because that's what people are writing about and thinking about. But what most interested me was how love doesn't really change in basic, in fundamental ways, and how the progression of relationships is unchanged, and a lot of the ways we try to change it backfire. A lot of the ways we try to find a shortcut through vulnerability don't work. And that's what was fun about this book, and using other people's stories to illustrate that.
So we are coming up on Valentine's Day, obviously. That's why we've done this Love Stories issue at the Book Review. I imagine that for your column, it's kind of the equivalent of, you know, the year's best or the 10 best books. What is going to be my Valentine's Day column? Do you think about that? And how are you going to deal with that 1 week each year?
I do think about it every year. In many years in the past, I wrote the column as a sort of editor's observations. And in fact, it was that process that led to me writing this book, because I thought I really wanted to do that in longer form and deeper. But I do think about this year, the Valentine's essay that comes out before Valentine's Day is by a woman, and it ends with a line that I'll give away that I think encapsulates how it's best to approach love. And she's debating about marriage, and she says, "I wanted the whole messy truth." And I feel like that represents the column and the experience of falling in love and committing to someone better than anything I could have said.
Well, it's a lovely little book. Love Illuminated, Exploring Life's Most Mystifying Subject with the Help of 50,000 Strangers by Daniel Jones. Editor of the New York Times' Modern Love column. Dan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
What's going on out there?
So this week we saw a very long-awaited book hit the shelves. It's the first book about the electronic surveillance by the government. It's a book written by Luke Harding, who is a reporter for The Guardian, and it's called The Snowden Files.
It's interesting to hear the term long-awaited with this, because this story is relatively new in the publishing world, not in the news world. And to get it out this quickly is actually kind of a feat, right, for us slow book people.
Yes, it is. And it's a real reflection of how publishers have become so much more attuned to the news cycle and so eager to jump on a very hot story and get, you know, what is not a quickie publication, but like a very well-researched, very thorough, very comprehensive book. It helps that this was written by a reporter who has covered this story from the beginning, but it was only 8 months ago that Edward Snowden burst onto the scene when he engineered the release of some of the United States' most closely held secrets on electronic surveillance.
Now, just to put this into perspective, that sounds like a long time, 8 months, but in the regular publishing cycle for non sort of news-driven books, you have 8 months for a book to even get to the publisher, often more, before it hits bookstores.
Right.
So this is very quick.
It's a very quick cycle. I mean, I've heard a lot of examples of a book that, you know, would come in, say, right now, and it wouldn't be put on a publisher's list until at least, you know, fall of the next year, probably later. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, while a book theoretically could be sent to a printer and, you know, bound and printed and appear in bookstores in 5 days, you know, bookstores have, they'd like to hear about things very early. Publishers need a long time to get sales and publicity and marketing revved up to, you know, they have a very long lead time, partly because they really just have to educate their accounts about what the book is.
And let's not forget, writers need time to write.
Yes, there's also that.
Right. I mean, Luke Harding must have worked very quickly on this book.
Very quickly. And it should be noted that Vintage, which is releasing the book in the United States, is publishing it in paperback and ebook editions rather than hardcover.
And do we have any sense of sales in the early days?
It is just coming out today, so we'll have to watch very closely in the days ahead to see how it does.
And there are a few other books you mentioned that are coming out to time also to this story.
That's right. Two very major books on the subject, which I think will also be very eagerly anticipated. Glenn Greenwald, one of the journalists who first broke this story, is writing a book for Metropolitan Books, part of Henry Holt. And that book is set for publication in April. I think that it was originally going to be released in March, but they pushed it back slightly. And also Barton Gellman, who's the well-respected reporter who covered the Snowden revelations for The Washington Post, is writing a book on what he called the rise of the surveillance industrial state for Penguin Press. And that book is not coming out in the immediate future, but I know when it does, it'll be a very major publication.
Okay, well then, lots of revelations to come. Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Pamela.
Parul Sehgal joins us now to talk about the love story issue, which she oversaw. Parul, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Pamela.
So tell us about the issue overall, and then we can talk about this wonderful roundup you did in which writers share what they've learned about love from literature.
Sure. Well, our special Valentine's Day issue has a mix of memoir and fiction and nonfiction. We've got books on the neuroscience of attachment. We have books about how women's sexuality changes over time, as well as novels, a novel about Queen Elizabeth, and a history book about, not a history book, but a history of Pat and Richard Nixon's relationship. So there's a lot of different things. Oh, and a romance shortlist.
That's right. So. And I also have to say, with a very sweet picture of Nixon and Pat, probably the most lovely
times,
right, photograph in the issue.
And the roundup, I think this is the third such roundup we've been doing in our themed issues. And this time, we thought we would ask a bunch of writers and poets about what literature has taught them about love. And this sort of came after, you know, the last couple of months seeing studies saying that, you know, reading novels makes us more empathetic, it makes us more compassionate, it can make us smarter. So we thought, you know, well, what do love stories teach us? Do we love any better?
Does it teach us emotional intelligence?
Exactly. And we got some fascinating responses. And I'm always fascinated by the roundups because you sort of realize that people read so idiosyncratically and for
yes.
so many different reasons, right? So some people read for blueprints, like this is the kind of life I want to live. Some people read to say, well, I want to peek at this life that I don't really want. Some people read for comfort. Some people read to challenge themselves. So you really get a very interesting look at how some of our favorite writers read and have read.
I also think, you know, again, for those of us who are big readers, that we often learn about love through books before we experience it ourselves, at least in the romantic sense.
Oh, as late bloomers.
Right. So it all comes down to what did we read when we were 14 and 15? And
No, absolutely. And I think the thing that this roundup showed me was that...
So if it was V.C. Andrews, it was about incest.
It's true. So many wrong turns. But like we do have narratives about love, right? So we think that like I'm this kind of person or this is the kind of person I fall in love with or this is what love is supposed to do. And novels are just so key, I think. Or novels, songs, movies to how we think about this. So we talked to Ruth Ozeki, a novelist, and she has this fabulous piece that she contributed about falling in love with a sonnet, a Shakespearean sonnet. It was Sonnet 129, which I hadn't read in years and years and years. And it's a very sort of bloody, violent sonnet. And she read it as a teenager. And she was just like, I would mutter it savagely in the nighttime and sort of stalk the corridors. And she wrote about sort of going back to the sonnet now and knowing just different things about love and just how that's changed.
I love the idea of reading a story, any kind, but especially a love story during different phases of your life, yeah. How Anna Karenina can go from being this incredibly romantic, story to then being a terrible tale of infidelity and betrayal, and how could she, and she deserved it, and then, you know, later on you come back to it and think, no, it is about love.
This is the Anne Patchett one I think you're referring to. So Anne Patchett wrote a little bit about when she first read Anna Karenina. She was just like, oh, you know, the love story between Anna and Vronsky, that was so exciting. Kitty and Levin are out there in the countryside farming. How dull.
Right.
And going back to it after, like, you know, 40-some years and just being like, God, Anna's shrill, you know. And poor, you know, Karenin is just trying to be decent. And I loved, and I think so many people actually talked about this, that how their conceptions of love were shaped by novels and then actually loving and living with someone for years and years and years and going to the novels and seeing something different.
So it's about love of rereading in many ways.
Absolutely. I love
and
that.
About how love then changes your own approach to what you read. Who else in this roundup? Because you really got a varied group.
Oh, and everybody wants to talk about love, I think. So we had Hilary Mantel, Gary Steingart, the poet laureate Natasha Trethewey, Colm Toy-Bean, Chris Ware, the graphic novelist, Eileen Miles, the poet, Charles Baxter, Helen Fielding, the author of Bridget Jones's Diary. We got some romance novelists who are very interesting because, I mean, in life, everybody, you know, has different sorts of ideas about love. But the romance novelists we talked about or talked to all talked about wanting to write happy endings as a sort of kindness and as a corrective of what they've, you know, sort of seen and learned. And I thought that was just so fascinating.
Someone said to me recently that the difference, and this can be hotly debated, but I'll throw it out there, that the difference between literary fiction, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. and quote-unquote commercial fiction, including romance, mm-hmm. is that in all novels or stories, people are looking for something. And in literary fiction, they don't find it. But in commercial fiction, they do. Yeah. And so you get those happy endings.
Yeah. Well, maybe.
All right. Well, we'll leave it on the note of happy endings. Thank you so much, Parle.
Thank you, Pamela.
Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, not a lot, actually. The only new titles on the hardcover lists this week are both on the fiction list. New at number 3, Anna Quinlan has a new novel out. It's called Still Life with Breadcrumbs.
Reviewed in this week's issue.
Not to be confused with Tom Robbins's Still Life with Woodpecker. The
right.
only other Still Life bestseller in the history of the bestseller list, by
wow.
the way. Yeah, it's, that was a 1980.
Be careful when putting Still Life in your book title.
or not be careful. I mean, maybe that's what makes it a bestseller. Unlike the Tom Robbins, the Anna Quinlan does not involve a love affair inside of a box of Camel cigarettes.
Important distinction.
And then new at number 8, the only other new title on the hardcover fiction list this week, Robert Harris's novel, An Officer and a Spy. This is a book about the Dreyfus Affair, which shook France in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And again, it's the first book, actually, about the Dreyfus Affair, fiction or nonfiction, ever to make the bestseller list.
Quelle horreur! All right. And nothing new on the nonfiction list.
There is nothing new on the nonfiction list this week. We do have a new title on the advice, how-to, and miscellaneous list that I wrote about in the column this week. Lala Anthony is the wife of the New York Knicks small forward Carmelo Anthony. He's their marquee player, regular all-star, NBA all-star. And Lala Anthony has been his wife for the past 3 years and his girlfriend for long before that. And she wrote a book called The Love Playbook, all about how to act in a relationship, how to secure your man. She says how to snag a baller, which, you know, her book doesn't actually tell women how to How to Land an NBA All-Star, but it does talk about, you know, it gives her relationship advice.
All right, then. Well, thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.